Welcome to the Global Research News Hour. I'm Steve Lindman. My guest today is Ramzi Baroud. Ramzi is pretty much a regular on this program to discuss such an important topic, what's happening in occupied Palestine. Ramzi is the editor-in-chief of Palestine Chronicle. Oh, it's about as good a website as I know to find out what's happening in Israel, Palestine, and in the Middle East, and so much more. He's also a former Al Jazeera producer. He's a prolific writer. He's written several books. He's writing a new book right now. His most recent one is very applicable to what's been happening for the past month, over the past month, in occupied Gaza. Ramzi wrote there's talk of a third Palestinian Intifada, and Ramzi's book is titled The Second Palestinian Intifada, A Chronicle of a People's Struggle. It's gone on for many, many decades, and it doesn't end. Ramzi, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me, Steve. It's always a pleasure.
Oh, Ramzi, it's a great delight and honor for me to have you on, and the news every day seems to be far less than pleasant, to say the least. And tomorrow's a big day in Israel. Few people in the U.S., I think listeners to this program may remember. I'll remind them if they forgot, but most people in the U.S. have no idea that there's a big election in Israel tomorrow. And it looks like, I don't know who's worse, Ramzi. It looks like Bibi Netanyahu will be prime minister again.
That is very much possible. In fact, most opinion polls in Israel have indicated that Netanyahu will, in fact, become the prime minister of Israel. As far as what is good and what's bad, unfortunately, we live at an age where it doesn't really make any difference anymore. It seems that the Israeli mainstream politics, regardless of the classifications that they wish to give themselves, right, left, center, radical left, and so forth, are all really, as far as the global standards, are all right-wing parties. I think the question is how far in the right are they? I think the center-left parties, such as Kadima, among others, were trying to prove to the Israeli public that they know that they are as right-wing as the Likud of Netanyahu is, and that's why, at least that explains one of the reasons of why Israel went to war in Gaza, killing this unprecedented number of people in such a short amount of time. So that's the sad reality, is that there's really very little that we can look forward to in this election, regardless of the outcome. The occupation is going to perpetuate, and civilians will continue to be killed.
Oh, indeed, that's all true, Ramzi. And Israel has more political parties than the U.S. Three main ones, and you're right. I mean, there would either be a prime minister from Likud, from Kadima, or Labor. Labor doesn't look to have much of a chance this time. But Yitzhak Rabin was from Labor. And now the choice is between Tippi Livni, the foreign minister, and Netanyahu. I have a thought, but when you hear that music, we need to break away, Ramzi. Let's break away, and when we come back, I'll mention one thought. Welcome back to the News Hour. I'm on with Ramzi Baroud. Ramzi, my thought was to extend from what you were saying about all of the politicians wanting to look tough. It seems to be the best way to gain votes. And back during the presidential campaign here in the U.S., I wrote an article that I titled, you may remember it, I titled it Vying to Be Toughness with Obama and who was the other guy? John
Biden.
McCain.
Joe Biden.
Each one trying to outdo the other and showing how tough they would be in fighting. Maybe certainly one of the worst words in the language, Ramzi, terrorists or terrorism.
Right. In fact, that was a unifying theme throughout the American elections. When Hillary Clinton was running against Obama, Obama wanted to prove that he is not going to be soft on terrorism, and Hillary Clinton was trying to, you know, pacify her critics who are accusing her because she is a woman, she is going to be soft and terror. So their language went as far as Obama calling for the bombing of Pakistan and Hillary Clinton taking even a more right-wing stance than she did. And of course, later on between Obama and John McCain and so forth and so on, this is the crisis that we have to deal with, is that we live at a time where everybody is trying to, you know, prove that I am committed to the so-called war on terror, and thus I will continue to hold on the credence that violence is going to be a solution. And of course, there are certain countries and certain governments that give themselves the right to what Noam Chomsky calls monopoly on violence, while others are denying even the right to defend themselves. I mean, this is the current issue. But the case in Israel is this has always been the issue. In fact, diplomacy has hardly ever been a popular topic in Israel. At least in Obama's case, he has at least shifted some of the rhetoric, saying we are going to be tough with Iran, but we are still going to, you know, open up a possibility of dialogue. Again, it will be a dialogue in which it's unconditional, and we are not going to be bullied into dialogue and so forth and so on. But the theme is there is dialogue, or there should be dialogue. In Israel, there is no such emphasis. Yes, they do talk about peace process and so forth, but that's for media purposes. That's for public relation purposes. It gets quoted heavily in CNN and Fox News, and makes Israel's friends that give them some sort of ammunition that they would present it to the international public opinion, saying, "Listen, Israel is talking about peace. Israel wants dialogue." But back in Israel, this is hardly the subject at all. Israel right now is a state that is militarized more than ever. The question of wiping out, obliterating, killing, destroying is the common language in the Hebrew media, and this is the prevailing language in Israel. And frankly, it has been the case for many, many years.
Well, Randy, absolutely. I sent you a new article this morning. You probably haven't had time to take a look at it yet. You're 2 hours behind me, but I call it A Short History of the Israeli-Palestinian Conflict, and I go into Zionist history from the very beginning when it was founded in 1897. And there's no question from Zionism split into two camps. The more moderates, like Israel's first president, Chaim Weizmann, not prime minister, but first president, and a prime minister, Moshe Sharet, but David Ben-Gurion was very, very hard-line. And there were two schools, the moderate school of Zionism and the hard-line school under the doctrine that a man named Zev Zabotinsky advocated back in the 1920s. And the doctrine basically was, I mean, this is crazy, Ramsey, the idea that the only language that Arabs understand is violence. So, and we can't look weak, so we have to be mean and tough, and we have to show them how tough we are, and we can't negotiate. We have to use violence and get them to realize that if they don't understand, we're going to keep repeating this. And then we'll negotiate, but we don't negotiate. We demand, and they either accept or it's back to violence again. And this has been Israel's way of operating, way of functioning in virtually all of its governments since the State of Israel was created in 1948.
And you would think that 60-plus years later they would have got it into their heads that violence is really not going to resolve anything. Because if they were capable of frightening Palestinians into submission, they would have done so with the first massacre in Deir Yassin in 1948, or the massacre of Beit Daras, or the massacre of Tantura. But massacre after massacre, war after war, and the Palestinians are still there, and they are still demanding their rights, and they are still as resolved and strong about it as ever. And yet the Israelis, or at least the Israeli leaders, refuse to acknowledge that, refuse to acknowledge that you cannot obliterate people's dreams. You cannot bombard people's want for freedom. It just, you cannot achieve that through napalm and through white phosphorus. It didn't happen in Gaza in the 70s. It didn't happen in the West Bank in the 60s. It didn't happen in back in historic Palestine in the late 40s. And it's not going to happen in Gaza today. Yet somehow this bizarre logic continues to perpetuate in Israel, continues to drive the Israeli political and military machines, thinking that you have to force Arabs into submission. That's the only way. But maybe that is the only way. But my question is, you have tried this recipe for 60 years, and you have failed every time. Doesn't logic command a different mode of action? Obviously not. Not for them, no.
Oh, absolutely, Ramsey. And history shows that violence over time never works. The history of our own country, pretty much, I guess there can be exceptions, but it didn't work in Vietnam. It didn't work in Korea. It really isn't working in Iraq. There's sort of a pause going on there now, but there's no question that the pot will be stirred and things will start up again because people don't want to be occupied. It absolutely is not working right now in Afghanistan. And Obama wants to double the number of U.S. forces there. It's an absurd idea. It'll accomplish absolutely nothing.
Right. And of course, it's a huge mistake. And again, I mean, you can apply the same thing that we just discussed in Palestine on Afghanistan. Afghanistan in particular, this is a country that has been dealing with violence for many, many years and various occupations from French to British to Russian to all sorts of occupations, and regardless of the means of resistance they have, regardless of the means of counter-violence, somehow they managed to repel every occupation, and it's the historical fact that the U.S. continues to ignore. Now Obama is committing a big mistake. As far as Iraq is concerned, well, you know, what is going on in Iraq right now is hardly the result of violence. It's the total opposite. There are all sorts of local dynamics, national dynamics in Iraq that provides this lull in violence. But my expectation is that if Obama does not come up with a dramatic change of course as far as the U.S. imperial plans in Iraq are concerned, if there is no dramatic shift in policies in Iraq, and really a justifiable sense of hope that the occupation is reaching the point of countdown right now, then most likely the violence is going to surge once more, and Iraq will go back to the a stage of a year ago, perhaps. So it's really the matter of time, and I think the White House decisions and the congressional decisions will affect the what is going on in Iraq in great ways.
Oh, indeed. Later in the month, Ramsey, I'll have Dodge Amail on the program, and he spent so much time there. He's in Baghdad right now, and he's done wonderful reporting on what's going on. And I'm not current on everything, but I do know that a great reason for less violence now than months back was we literally bought off the resistance, at least at some time, for $300 a month to go to work for us. In other words, to be local enforcers the way Israel wants Palestinians to be for them and gets Fatah under Abbas to be for them. And, well, this may work for a while, but, again, people absolutely don't want to be occupied, and sooner or later the resistance will rise up again. The Iraqis did it to the Brits back in the early part of the last century. The Afghans have done it repeatedly, and they're doing it again. And, of course, they ousted the Russians in the 1980s, and the Russians had a much bigger force in Afghanistan than we do,
right.
And they're doing it again right now. And both occupations will end. It's just a question of how and when. And
at what cost as well.
And at what cost.
And this is what we are really, I mean, we know it's going to end. You know, history does not stop ever repeating itself. We know that. We know that the Israeli occupation is going to end. We know that the U.S. occupation of Iraq and Afghanistan are going to end, Steve. But the question is at what cost and why? Why allow that cost to be exacted, knowing that the price is going to be heavy on both sides? Why not use the language of reason and resort to logic as a way out so that we can achieve that absolute end we know is going to end, but why not achieve it at a much less costly price and now?
Oh, indeed, Ramsey. We need to take another break. Let's do that, and we'll be right back.
This is Cascadia Public Radio.
Welcome back to the News Hour. I'm on with Ramsey Baroud. Ramsey, on Friday, Noam Chomsky was on the program. And I quoted what he said in one of his recent articles, maybe his most recent, and it's something I absolutely believe, and I've written it myself, that Israel's policy of violence, unless it changes, will dictate their future, and that future may be that Israel will end up destroying itself. It will be consumed amidst its own violence, and I think the same thing is true for America.
And I can't agree more with Chomsky on this. Noam Chomsky his writing has been very revealing for many years, of course. I mean, since the 70s, when a lot of people barely had the courage to address this issue as an equitable issue between two people, or at least between a nation that is struggling for its freedom and another that is asserting its dominance. Chomsky was one of the leading voices that really did emphasize this reality at a time when people were petrified of addressing this issue and speaking on behalf of the Palestinians in any way that made any sense. And now he continues to do so, and his ideas continue to be admired and continue to be revealing in many ways. And this is indeed another Chomsky first. I mean, this is the idea that Israel is bringing its own demise with its own action. And if you look, Steve, at Israel's past, yes, true that violence has been the nature of the Israeli state before it, in fact, became a state until today. But the nature of politics have changed in Israel, have changed dramatically. Israel in its early days was more or less a pragmatic colonial power, pragmatic in the sense it knew exactly what it wanted. It had pragmatic leaders who had fixed goals, and they would do anything to achieve these goals. Right now, Israel, as a society, is largely a racist society. The great majority of Israelis are saying that they would rather live without Arabs anywhere inside. They would. A majority of the Israelis said that they wouldn't want to have an Arab as a neighbor. The majority of Israelis saying that they would like to see the Arabs expelled from the minority Arabs expelled from Israel. But also the mainstream politics in Israel, the fact that Netanyahu, who is the head of the Likud party, the one that is expected to win in the coming elections, is already promising that he is going to hold alliances with two major parties, and that is Israel Baituna of Avigdor Lieberman and the Shas party. Now, you know, for those who don't know the Shas party and Avigdor Lieberman's party, these are like the equivalent of the KKK in the U.S. Fortunately, the KKK is now not only has penetrated Israeli politics, but they are main players in shaping the Israeli political agenda.
And the Shas
Netanyahu is already promising that Lieberman and Shas are going to be his partners in the new coalition government that he's hoping to assemble as soon as he is elected to power.
So Ramsey, the Shas party is a religious party.
Yes, and it's
So you've got religious leaders of Israel that are extremely to the right of center. I mean, these people, it almost sounds like a strange way to say this, but they're fascist rabbis.
That is indeed the case, Steve, and it's really frightening. I mean, you know, we hear this quite often from, the liberal media that they are extremists on both sides, kind of as a way to remove ourselves from taking any stance on the issue. But this cannot in any way be compared to Hamas and the Islamic Jihad on the Palestinian side. Disagree with their religious ideology, and I personally do, but that is another issue. The actual demands are pretty rational, and they are the same demands that the socialists in Palestine hold, the nationalists, and the secular movement in Palestine carries. But if you compare it with Shas and Israel Beituna, these guys talk about ethnic cleansing. They come up with addicts that are frightening. I mean, we are talking about rabbis ordering the killing of 1,000 Arab for every Jewish victim. And if that does not, solve the problem, then we upgrade the number to 10,000, then 100,000, and so on. This is mainstream politics / religion in Israel. And it's reported, of course, in Israeli media left and right, from Arif to Yudaot Ahronot to Haaretz to the Jerusalem Post. It hardly makes an appearance in our media here. It hardly is discussed as a subject that deserves discussion. Why is this the case? Why such calls for eradicating the very existence of Palestinians is not an issue deserving of discussion in this country is something that I find surprising, and until now I can't really figure it out. Why is this the case?
And even worse, Ramsey, the great majority of Israelis support the hardline stance. It really is incredible. I understand people wanting to be secure, but people need to understand that you don't gain security by attacking other people, because that makes them want to attack back. They need to do something in their own self-defense.
Absolutely.
And the way to stop the killing.
Security, Steve, after the return from the commercial, but it's a really important issue, and I think we need to talk more about it.
Oh, it's a vital issue. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network, because you can handle the truth.
Welcome back to the News Hour. I'm on with Ramsey Baroud. Ramsey, let me let you pick up on the topic of security, because it's such a vital issue.
It is indeed, Steve. As we know, there are terminologies that permeates this conflict, such as peace, security, peace process, and so forth. Every period, every phase in this conflict has its own dominating terminology. One persisting term is that of security. And the term is very tricky, because very few can really argue against anybody's right to be secured, whether as an individual or as a collective. The problem with Israel's security, as far as the Palestinians are concerned, is that Israel's security is an exclusive term, meaning that it refers to Israel's security, never to the Arabs. It's always Israel's security, never the Palestinians. Now, Israel expects and demands security and tries to achieve that demand by the most violent means possible. They want security, but they would not bring to an end the colonial project. They want security for their citizens, but they take these citizens in violation of the 4th Geneva Convention, and they move them to the West Bank and Gaza and to East Jerusalem, to the occupied Palestinian lands of 1967. They deprive people of their lands, farmers of their farms, and so forth. They demolish homes, and they build settlements. And they tell the Arabs, you can't fight back. You can't ask for your land back. And if you do, then this is a violation of the tenet of security. And this is what is so bizarre about this concept, is that Israel demands something that is impossible to achieve. Of course, Israel will not achieve security, because security is something that the oppressed cannot give you. It's your action as the colonizer, it's your action as the oppressor that is going to determine the type and direction of the violence directed against you. Of course the farmer is going to fight you back, and his children and his children's children are going to fight you back. But if this is a violation of your right to be secured, then you are really setting some amazingly ridiculous demands here. You cannot expect to be a colonialist, a settler state that perpetuates violence and lives and thrives on violence, and at the same time expect your subjects, expect the colonialized, the oppressed, to provide you with security. This is ridiculous. And we know very well it's not going to happen. Not now, not in 100 years. It's Israel's actions that are going to determine whether Israel deserves and needs and receives security at the end or not.
Oh, there's no question about it. And it's hard for people who don't live through things like this to really understand what you're saying, Ramsey. It's hard for people in America to understand that everyday Palestinians, not just in Gaza has made headlines because of the war there for 3 weeks, but every day in the West Bank, people's lives are in complete disruption. They live in isolated cantons. The Israeli military is all over the place. They're literally hemmed in by what Professor Jeff Halpert calls a matrix of control. And we should try to imagine our own neighborhoods that we live in here. If every time we went out, there were soldiers, not police, but soldiers with heavy weapons all over the place. These soldiers, on no pretext whatsoever, could barge into your home, break into your home, take over your home, arrest a member of your family, do anything they want, give no reasons, maybe shoot someone in your family. People get angry, and they want to respond. I mean, this is a natural human reaction. You keep punching somebody, and they're going to punch you back. They're only going to take so much for so long. And this is the daily life of people who only want to live in peace. But Israel won't let them live in peace. And it goes on and on.
And exactly, Steve. And you may already know that, but I was born and raised in a refugee camp in Gaza.
Oh, yes.
My family came from one of the villages in historic Palestine that was destroyed by Zionist militias in 1947, 1948. And really, the great majority of Gazans after that became refugees and descendants of refugees from historic Palestine. We lived in refugee camps. We used to, after 1967, when Israel took over the rest of historic Palestine, that our first contact, well, more or less, with living under Israeli occupation. Of course, we protested. We carried all sorts of civil disobedience activities. We striked and so forth. And every time, regardless of the type of action we carried out, whether it was collective nonviolent action or whether it was a violent action, of course, it's always modest violent action. At the time, the Israeli response would always be bombs and whizzing bullets and mass arrests and torture and humiliation and mass imprisonment and curfews that have a beginning and don't have an end and so forth and so on. And funny, because speaking about this issue from Seattle right now, it's different than when you are living in Gaza under that type of experiencing that type of living. And someone like Israel, who is imprisoning you, treating you like animals, controlling your every move, denying you your every freedom, And then hearing Israeli prime ministers and Israeli officials and reading the Israeli media from Gaza talking about how it's really your fault and how Israel, all that Israel wants is to live in security. And you kind of open your window outside and you look at the Israeli tanks and you look at the Israeli helicopters controlling you and watching you and ready to strike and assassinate at every given moment. I mean, can you even imagine the type of, what would a Gazan think when they hear such terminology as security? This is the sad reality, because most Americans, when they hear that, they feel like, well, I mean, Livni has a point. She spoke at YouTube, and she spoke at CBS, and she spoke at CNN, and she said, we are a democratic nation that are trying to live in peace, so please leave us alone. At that, of course, it makes good sense. But what people really need to understand that this is a shadow of reality. Reality is that it's Israel that is not leaving the Palestinians alone. That Israel that is controlling their every move and controlling their life and subjugating them in every humiliating way imaginable, and at the same time expecting to be left alone and expecting to live in peace and expecting security. So I really kind of, I want your listeners to really try to imagine the situation the way it is, not the way it's presented to them through the mainstream media. And that's a whole new subject, of course.
And, of course, the language is very clever, Ramsey. Somebody speaking for their nation and saying Israel, or the same thing could be said about the U.S., any country, but Israel has a right to defend itself. Well, of course Israel has a right to defend itself, but Israel nor any other country has a right to attack another country or another people or another group or another person. And if they do, and those groups or people or nations respond with their own violence, international law says they have every right to do it, even an obligation to do it. Ramsey, one thing that we didn't get into the last time you were on, and I don't want to forget to do it this time, so while I'm thinking of it, let me bring it up. It's a slight change of direction, but to me it's important. Your sister is a doctor in Gaza, and you told me, I think you mentioned this the last time you were on, that hundreds of Gazans wounded during the 3 weeks of fighting, and of course the fighting continues even now. Israel continues to launch an attack here, an attack there, whatever it wants to do. But you said, your sister said, there are hundreds of Gazans who are clinically dead. And you're in regular touch with your sister. What is the situation now for all of these people who were terribly, terribly injured by the weeks of fighting? Have you any current information on what's happening with them?
I do, Steve, and thank you so much for bringing up this subject. As we know, Gaza is connected to the outside world, at least by land, through six entry points. Five that connect Gaza to Israel, and one that connects Gaza to Egypt, and thus to the rest of the world. Expectedly, the five entry points to Israel are closed. But unfortunately, the entry point to Egypt has always been closed, and as a result, Palestinians have been resorting, as we all know, to digging tunnels between Gaza and Egypt to get to the other side of the Sinai Desert, buy food or medicine, and then go back. The problem with most of the wounded is that there is insufficient amounts of medications in Gaza. There are decaying medical equipment, and Palestinians have not been allowed to import new equipment or repairs, because this is a violation of the Israeli siege. Some injured Palestinians were allowed into Egypt. But these those who were allowed into Egypt were really more or less kind of a symbolic token that Egypt was using it for propaganda reasons, that the border is open and Palestinians are allowed to go out. But the reality is very few were allowed to leave, and those who left were those who had moderate injuries. Those who are critically injured or clinically dead are, of course, cannot be transported. Thus, you still have hundreds of them still in Gaza. The other main issue, the other important issue, is that you have at least 1,500 Palestinians who are estimated to kind of sustain not permanent injuries, but rather permanent disabilities. These are people who are going to live with their disabilities for the rest of their lives. There is very little by way of medical establishment in Gaza that would allow for the rehabilitation of these people. Another issue that I just learned about recently from Dr. Franklin Lamb, who's a, I'm not sure if you are familiar with his writing. He is
an international lawyer.
And he brought up a very important issue a couple of days ago, and that is the fact that there are hundreds of stillborn babies who actually died with their mothers during the Israeli war. So we are still really learning about the level of devastation. You know, when we are counting casualties, we like to simplify, you know, this number of dead, this number of injured, and that's the end of the story. But the fact is the story doesn't end there. In fact, for thousands and thousands of Gazans, the story is just beginning. It's just the beginning of the story. And what is even more tragic about it is, okay, we live the nightmare. But can the nightmare be over so we can move on with our lives? We can rehabilitate our injured kids. Can we try to save those who were critically injured? But the nightmare did not come to an end there. The siege still continues on Gaza. Hospitals are still lacking pretty much everything. And those who suffered are still suffering as a result. And unfortunately, the media is reporting that the war has ended and all is back to normal in Gaza, which is far away from the truth.
And, of course, the U.S. media reports so abysmally, Ramsey, as we both know, when anything like this comes up, including the BBC, it's grossly one-sided. And, of course, BBC refused to air a fundraiser for Gazans in desperate need of all the things that you're talking about and so much more. And there are some media in the U.K. that are airing a humanitarian fundraiser, and BBC refused to air it. Well, of course, they got direct orders from their government, and Israel probably gave Washington direct orders. Then Washington gave the UK direct orders, and the UK gave BBC, because BBC is owned by the government. That makes them very impartial. So they refused to air a humanitarian fundraiser. Humanity having nothing whatsoever to do with politics, but because, you know, Gaza, Hamas, etc., and so forth, well, let the people suffer. That's basically BBC's message. And the U.S. media, its complete dismissiveness, along with the politicians, and again, most people in the country have no idea what's going on.
Exactly. And this is in a country, I mean, Britain, I mean, I lived there for a while until recently, and the British citizens, for various reasons, notwithstanding the physical geographic proximity to the Middle East, have largely been informed and engaged in what's going on in there. Yet despite all of that, the main media in Britain, the BBC, which kind of defines the course of media action in Britain, if not even worldwide, decided to become partial all of a sudden. And what is really so weird about that whole issue of partiality is the fact that the BBC was never partial in this conflict. In fact, you know, recent reports spoke about, you know, the person who is heading the BBC, Mr. Thompson, was in Israel in 2005. He took his wife to Israel to meet with Ariel Sharon. He wanted to tell the right-wing Israeli prime minister that the BBC is not anti-Semitic and it's not anti-Israel, and we really want to understand you even better, as if the BBC has not done a good enough job of conveying the Israeli point of view. This is like the Thompson going to Damascus and sitting with Khaled Mashal, the head of Hamas, and assuring him, you know, on a personal level, that we respect you and we respect everything you do. And so, of course, the BBC was never partial, but I think that the response of the BBC and various other media and mainstream media in America and elsewhere is unprecedented, in the sense that the level of Israeli violence was unprecedented. There was no room for partiality here. If I am going to cover this subject, then I need to talk about the fact that thousands of people have been killed, wounded, and maimed on one side, and 13 people on the other side. I need to discuss the fact that tens of thousands of homes have been destroyed, and then there is a whole population that is being starved and reduced at every level. This is a crisis that is man-made crisis. And any responsible media would provide this a humanitarian crisis, at least on a humanitarian level, not on a political level. That's another story, but at least on a humanitarian level, with the kind of coverage that it needs and deserves. Very little of that. Very little of that. And yet, despite all of this, Steve, people all over the world, publics all over the world, managed to read between the lines. And they managed to understand that despite all this media hype of terrorism and Palestinian violence and Israel defending itself and all of that nonsense, they managed to really see that this is not an equal proportionate conflict, that this is a conflict that is being carried out largely against a defenseless population. And they went outside in by the millions in the biggest popular reaction to war since Iraq and before that since Vietnam. In response to what Israel is doing, demanding an end.
Welcome back to the News Hour. Ramsey, we just have a few minutes left. I want to give them to you, except I do want to say this. Let's consider you and I together on air. To be continued on a future program, because this story goes on and on and on, and there'll be a new prime minister in Israel once they get the results tomorrow tallied. The current prime minister, Olmert, will be out. There'll be somebody new in, but the policies won't change. About the only change there may be is they'll get worse, not better. But we absolutely have to continue this, Ramsey, and I hope you will come back and we'll do this again.
Of course, Steve. I would love to come back, and I thank you very much for giving me this opportunity to speak about Palestine. And I know that you dedicate a lot of your time and writing and articles and programs to this important issue, and I admire you very much for that.
Oh, it's deep in my craw. It eats at me, not like it eats at you, Ramsey, because as you say, you were born in a Gaza refugee camp, and I was born in America. I didn't go through what you've been through, but the more I learn, the more it eats at me, and it's become one of my core issues, as you know.
Thank you, Steve, and of course I know that, and I just would like to kind of finish by saying, there is elections in Israel indeed, and the media is going to focus on how will the winner of those elections going to determine the future directions of Israel? And I'm telling you from now, regardless of who is going to be elected in Israel, is going to make very little difference. The issue remains not Livni versus Barak versus Ehud Olmert versus Lieberman versus any of these guys or Netanyahu. The issue is an issue of justice and equality and freedom. It's an issue that is the essence of that conflict. It's an issue of a state that thinks that it has the right to carry out collective punishment and perpetuate violence in such ways as we saw in Gaza and get away with it and still speak as if it's the victim and still speaks as if it's a country that has the right to do such and such and such. Well, the issue is really not that at all. It's the issue of international law that has been violated for so many times and for so many years. And until that issue is dealt with forcefully by those who are in charge of the world order, whomever that force is, whether it's the U.S. now or someone else tomorrow, then the issue is going to carry on. The conflict is going to continue. We need to see an alignment of foreign policy of this country. We need to understand that we are tying our fate to that of Israel, and Israel is bringing us down. Our reputation, our leadership, our status worldwide is dwindling because we have allied ourselves with a country like Israel, a country that thrives on foreign policy that can only be defined in one term: piracy. That's what it is, Steve, and people need to understand that.
Oh, indeed. Israel is lawless. Israel is a rogue state. Israel is a serial aggressor. It's got nothing to do with Jewishness. It's got nothing to do with religion. It's a political issue. It's a rule of law issue. It's a humanitarian issue. And no nation has the right to just go its own way, ignore the law, whether it's Israel, whether it's the U.S., whether it's anybody else. This cannot stand, and one day it no longer will. Oh, Ramsey, we're out of time. That music means they'll cut away momentarily. Again, I want to thank you for coming on, and this will be continued because this story continues, and we need to talk about it to get information to more and more people. It's the only way to make change. We need to inform people so they'll get angry like you and I are, Ramsey, and this touches us directly. We need to stop it before it's too late.
We do. Thank you, Steve.
Thank you, Ramsey. And we'll be back tomorrow with another program. Please come back and join us.